KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
They felt Merrick Bob was the best. They took an 8-1 vote. They said that's the city's position. You know, I think that's a mistake, but it's now the city's position.
The idea of just having these eyes in the sky, we just really don't envision that, and we don't have a use for that.
This is Washington. We know how you're going to vote. Everybody in the world knows how Washington votes, right?
Comedian Greg Fitzsimmons is going to talk about the election a little later in the show. Sean Whitcomb was talking about drones. He's a Seattle Police Department officer. Mayor McGinn was talking about Merrick Bob and the Department of Justice oversight of Seattle Police Department reforms. Those are things we're going to take up today on Weekday on KUOW Seattle. Do stick around. Nancy Pearl as well. But we start with a pretrial hearing for Staff Sergeant Robert Bales at Joint Base Lewis-McChord. It starts today. Sergeant Bales is accused of sneaking out of his combat outpost and shooting men, women, and children in two remote villages outside of Kandahar, Afghanistan, one night in March, 8 months ago. Staff Sergeant Bales could face the death penalty. He was stationed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, where the hearing is being held. Gene Johnson is Seattle-based AP reporter covering today's events.
Today's pretrial hearing is a chance for the prosecutors to present their case to an investigating officer who is charged with recommending whether there's enough evidence of the crime for the case to advance to a court-martial.
Do they... How much evidence gets presented? Do they basically present their whole case?
It's not clear. I mean, we don't. We expect a lot of it to be the same stuff that would get presented at the court martial. But you know, the defense doesn't call their own witnesses. It's more of just a preliminary hearing, just to. For the investigating officer to be able to make a recommendation about whether the case should advance.
What does the defense do in a case like in a day like this?
Well, they get to cross-examine the witnesses. They'll be trying to elicit anything that they can that might be helpful to their client's case. In this case, they say that they will try to get whatever they can regarding any possible mental health defense. You know, they said that Staff Sergeant Bales was suffering from PTSD and that he had sustained a concussive head injury during one of his Iraq deployments. So they may try to elicit some testimony about that.
I read an article interviewing his wife in the hours leading up to this pretrial hearing say he couldn't do it. Doesn't the military say they have video of Bales leaving and returning to the base?
Well, they do, and we expect to get our first glimpse of that video today. The prosecutors are expected to show. This was video that was taken with a surveillance blimp as Bales returned to the base and surrendered. So we are expecting to get our first look at that. Another one of the highlights of the hearing, I guess, is that you know, this is going to run for about, you know, several days, maybe up to 2 weeks, and part of the hearing is going to be held overnight to allow some testimony from witnesses who are still in Afghanistan, some of the villagers and soldiers, etc.
And Bales defense attorney John Henry Brown says he's going to put the war on trial. Does that start today?
Well, you know, like as I said, I'm not sure how much of that he's going to be able to get into, just because this isn't necessarily the chance for the defense to really put on their best case. But certainly, if John Henry Brown has an opportunity to do that, we expect him to do it.
And Gene Johnson, once the hearing is over, if it takes as long as you say it takes, when do the judges release their ruling?
You know, it's not clear how long it would take, but it gets referred to the convening authority, who here at Joint Base Lewis McChord, who's the general who makes the decision ultimately about whether this goes forward.
That's Gene Johnson, Seattle-based AP reporter. He's covering today's pretrial hearing of Staff Sergeant Robert Bales at Joint Base Lewis McChord. Excuse me. Staff Sergeant Bales is accused of twice leaving his combat outpost on the night of March 11th, 2012, shooting 16 civilians, men, women, and children in two Afghan villages. He could face the death penalty. Mayor Mike McGinn is in our studios. The mayor of Seattle joins us to talk about some of the issues facing the city and to take your calls. Apparently my cold is still laying a little bit in my throat, so I apologize as I get hoarse. Thank you for being here, sir.
Good to be here.
You are looking at pictures of Hurricane Sandy. You have some family back there.
I do. I grew up on the south shore of Long Island. My sister Sheila lives on Long Beach, in the city of Long Beach, which is one of the barrier beaches. It's on one of the barrier beach islands that run the length of, you know, New Jersey, New York, further south, further north, too. It's basically a long, flat beach, the dune line, and then behind the dunes are, in the case of Long Beach, tightly packed houses.
How did she weather the storm?
Unclear whether her house will be condemned or not. People saw what happened in Manhattan, 11-foot storm surge pretty much simultaneously with a very high tide. And what that meant was that those barrier beaches up and down the coast had several feet of water just going right over the top of them.
What's remarkable is now, a week later about, you know, people are getting cold. They got another storm coming in. There's a lot of people still without power, though more power has been restored. Transportation is still tough. Gasoline turning out to be an amazing problem.
Well, one of the things one of the things is the number of people displaced, and you know, whether you're talking 20,000 or 40,000 or more, it's a really significant number. They're actually trying to get a finger on it, you know, and understand it. In places like Long Beach and in Long Island, loss of water, power, sewer as well, making places virtually uninhabitable, even if the building is inhabitable, but in that case, you know, basements filled with water, to the extent, you know, oil tanks could get knocked over, toxics could get spread around. So it's a real challenge. So, you know, for those with means, with money, they'll, you know, look to find something. But a lot of places that were hit were, you know, low income or housing projects as well. So they've got real challenges right now.
All right. So what does that make you think about our preparation here?
You know, good question. Before we do that, I just want to give a shout out to the folks from Seattle City Light. We and the U.S. Air Force, a C-17 carried, maybe multiple C-17s, carried four of our trucks, big trucks that set poles and do lines and have the cherry pickers on them. 19 of our crewmen, line crews, flew to Long Island. It turns out we have Long Island and Seattle City Light have a mutual assistance pact. So the U.S. Air Force gave them a ride out, and I saw them off on Saturday morning, which was great.
Who pays for that?
In this case, will be reimbursed. So it's either
by the federal government, or
either
the state?
Feds or the state, one or the other, and that's why that mutual assistance agreement means so much. It lays out the circumstances. My understanding is that, you know, crews from, you know, all over the Midwest and Northeast that weren't hit by the storm have been going to the aid of those affected communities. We're a little further away, so it did take for the U.S. Air Force to come in and offer to fly us over.
That's remarkable, though. They flew the trucks out there.
It's really cool. I got to see the inside of one of those planes. They're big. But it was great to see that we were using our resources in that way. What does it mean for us?
Well, but let me hold you there for a minute. I mean,
sure.
I'm if you don't mind me channeling Tea Party and
you try every show. You try every show, but go for it.
Why should Seattle in any way, shape, or form be contributing to New Jersey when New Jersey should pay for itself, shouldn't it?
Well, look, in some way or
another. Let's not even talk about the federal government.
No, in some way or another, we will be reimbursed as part of this effort. And we already have, we have planes, we have pilots, and they fly missions already. So I'm glad to see them flying a mission like this.
In the Air Force.
In this case, the Air Force. Yeah, in this case, the Air Force. And we will be, you know, we will be reimbursed. And, you know, there may come a day when we'll be really grateful when folks from around the country come to help us here in Seattle. Because the fact of the matter is we're on, you know, we could have a very serious earthquake here, as well as extreme weather events like they face there. Not quite the same as a hurricane, but big snowstorms, big windstorms. We know that they can knock out power and cause a lot of damage.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's in the Constitution, though. helping the other
I believe that we are trying to form a more perfect union.
Is that where you come under there?
I think it would come right.
Take that under the Commerce Clause too.
I think it would come right under there. Yeah, and it's a big deal. You know, I think the other thing, as long as we're learning lessons, you really have to be prepared. We ask people to be ready for at least 3 days without help, and think about the folks in the Northeast. In some cases, it's taken a few days for the media to even find, you know, the damage. I mean, they're as challenged as everybody else to get out and see what's happening and report the story. And in this case, you know, here we are a week later, and they're still working to restore, you know, power, you know, water, sewer to affected areas. They're probably inspecting a lot of buildings right now, determining whether they're safe for reoccupation.
People that own generators are probably pretty happy with themselves on this side of the country.
Yeah, so you really have to be prepared in terms of having water, drinking water, food, a supply of food. As I'm learning from this one, I've got to go out and shop myself. Put what you own into a 5-gallon bucket with a lid. Yeah, because you might need that 5-gallon bucket with a lid if you don't have a sewage.
Mm-hmm.
You're gonna want someplace and a bottle of bleach to go with it. I learned this from Ray Hoffman, head of Seattle Public Utilities. So really think about having the supplies on hand to help yourself and your family for the first at least 3 days, and after that, you know, to tie it back to the beginning, we'll be needing help too. And so it's good that we. We have a really good emergency management director in Barb Graff, and she's not just works in the city, but she's a leader in the region. So that's part of her job, is to continue to work not just on what do we do locally, but what are the arrangements we have with other places to get assistance and then use that assistance effectively when it arrives.
The seawall's on the ballot.
Yes.
What would happen in terms of downtown public safety if that seawall collapsed?
And, you know, I think this is where the New York situation is really instructive, because the seawall holds Elliott Bay back. It would go back to First Avenue in some places without it. And so there's a lot of buildings that would be, you know, would have their foundations, would have their feet in the water, and that would be bad. A lot there. But we also run a lot of utility lines right along the waterfront, as well as it being a major transportation corridor with the Alaska Way Viaduct. So the seawall is not just about the buildings right behind it, because all the utility lines, a lot of our utilities run there, as well as the transportation corridor. It would have regional effects if we lost the seawall. We could lose it in an earthquake. There's even the potential to lose it in a big storm, because it's made of wood and it's rotting out.
You got those gribbles.
We got the gribbles in there. Yeah, and it was never designed for seismic activity.
Is that right?
No. The pilings are basically, the pilings don't get down below the loose soils. They don't reach all the way down into the hard soils. So what that means is, if you have liquefaction, you know, if you have a shake, the loose soils liquefy, and the pilings then really aren't holding on to anything, and they just go.
Much of the seawall is going to be rebuilt.
Yes.
Why rebuilding rather than repairing?
It's simply, as I said, it's made of wood. The pilings don't reach down to the hard soil. So it's not just a question of fixing the side that faces the seawater, which we do, by the way. We have to patch that up. We've had situations where the wall, the facing gives way, and then you lose a lot of the soils behind it. So you got to put a patch in and then refill what's behind it, which is why there's even a risk in a big storm. But in an earthquake, you got to get the footings down to the hard soils, so it'll hold in an earthquake.
Seawall is going to be much in front of the tunnel that's being dug.
That's right.
The tunnel's turning up under Western and even under there.
The tunnel work can proceed without the seawall. But we need the seawall to be done before we tear down the elevated and rebuild the waterfront. Because you just have to, it's laying the foundation. You have to do the foundation first. No way around it. And we're also looking at, where should it be exactly?
The seawall.
Yeah, there's and how can you, learn a little bit from the past, not just in the safety, but that's a salmon migration corridor, so you can make the face of the seawall more, something that can support life so that the fish can do better. It's not just a desert for them to go through. Get more light into the water. And there are places where we can maybe get a beach. As you get further south of the ferry terminal, the water is shallower there, and we might even be able to get a beach out of that if we do it right.
If this seawall request passes, does that all the money that you need for building the seawall?
For what we're calling the central seawall project. So
does that include that beach area you mentioned?
Yeah, so that will give us all the money we need for the central area. Now, north, we only go so far north, kind of up to where the pier is, where the concerts were. We go past that. After that, that's another section of seawall that we'll also have to look to finance in the future. But that one doesn't have the same population right behind it or the same utility line issues, nor is it supporting the viaduct. So we're starting with the most vulnerable and most important section first. And we'll have to do it in multiple summers because you only get a certain amount of window of time to operate due to weather and fish migration patterns.
I look forward to being downtown when the tunnel and the seawall are both being under construction.
Man, we got construction. I am glad to report that it looks like we'll be opening up the Spokane Street Viaduct very soon. That construction will be complete finally, which is great. And we've rebuilt a part of Mercer. Now we're going to start the next part of Mercer, which is going under Aurora. But hopefully we'll get that Fairview intersection done soon too. But there's going to be a lot of construction for a number of years affecting getting in and out of downtown and getting through downtown.
Too bad people couldn't do something like, take a train or a bus.
What a nice segue, Steve. And we have put money into our budget to...
What's he want? What's Mike O'Brien want?
Who knows? He probably wants to talk... Mike O'Brien, if you want to speak to me, you have to call Steve Scher at KUOW. And the phone number is...
206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. That'd be very good.
So you teed this up. Thank you. When I took office, we launched a transit master planning process for the city of Seattle. We had a transit master plan. It had a monorail in it. It needed to be updated. And we got a really good team together that analyzed where's the highest demand for travel in the city. And what we found was that there were 20 corridors, which we needed to improve, and 5 high-capacity corridors. And what we have sought to do in our budget is for each of the high-capacity corridors, begin the planning that would enable us to get high-capacity transit on them. And this is a really key finding from the Transit Master Plan. And sometimes you have to hire an expert to tell you something that, you might have been able to figure out all by yourself. We're doing a better job of connecting regional centers to regional centers with Link Light Rail and Express Bus Service. We're not doing such a great job of connecting Seattle neighborhoods to each other. And so that's what we're focusing on the transit plan. And so that includes jointly working with Sound Transit on getting rail to Ballard, starting planning to connect the First Hill streetcar to the South Lake Union streetcar, looking at extending the streetcar out from South Lake Union all the way to the U District.
There's a way to turn those off.
I'm turning this off now. There we go. I'm sorry. I was so excited to talk about rail. Steve, I couldn't, and you know, I'm from the East Coast, so I was talking with my hands, so I did not have a hand free to turn the phone off.
Fair enough. Oh, okay. So I'll tell you what, and we'll tee and tease up this way. I want to ask what the status is of the Eastlake Rail notion as well. Mayor Mike McGinn is our guest. We're going to take your phone calls as well. As you heard, Mike O'Brien might be first. 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Also, if you have questions for the mayor of Seattle, Mike McGinn, you can email us weekday at kuow.org.
It's 9:25. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst. Later today, we'll explore the weird and wonderful world of science fiction with Nancy Pearl. She'll give us some recommendations and take your phone calls at 10:20.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University, offering master's degrees for leadership development, designed for working professionals in the arts, government, and nonprofit organizations. Details on curriculum and information sessions at Seattle University College of Arts and Sciences.
Cloudy skies and 54 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting a high today of 59. Clouds all day with a slight chance of showers. It's going to be cloudy tonight with some overnight fog, the low in the mid-40s. We're expecting clouds and showers tomorrow, the high in the mid-50s.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen on his Old Ideas World Tour. Leonard Cohen will be performing live at Key Arena on Friday, November 9th. Tickets are on sale now through Ticketmaster. More information at aeglive.com.
Mike Begin, here's an email question for you, though, before we go to rail. I just want to jump back to the seawall, because Lance writes, why should property owners be on the hook for funding the seawall when the seawall benefits businesses, port, and citizens of the entire region, not just those that live within the city of Seattle boundaries? Shouldn't this proposition be on the King County or state ballot instead?
Well, that issue was decided a number of years ago when the governor, then Mayor Greg Nickels, and then County Executive Ron Sims made a deal. And part of the deal was that we would build a tunnel. The tunnel would be something the state would take on, although they added the infamous cost overrun provision later, and that there would be money for the county to expand bus service. We're still waiting for that money to arrive. And part of the deal that was cut was City of Seattle's responsible for the seawall. So that's the deal we made. That's the deal that was affirmed by the city council. And that's what we're doing. Now, having said that, we are getting flood control money from the county to the tune of about $30 million. So we are part of a flood control district. Most of that is used for river flooding and taking care of the levees. Seattle pays into that fund. We'll be getting some of what we pay into that fund back in the form of the $30 million for the seawall. So that is a way in which the county is helping out.
What money were you waiting for that you said you have yet to see the money? What was that?
One of the promises back at that three-way deal, the three-government deal, was that there'd be a 1% motor vehicle excise tax for the county on bus service. And that 1% MVET hasn't arrived yet. The legislature hasn't passed it.
That was just part of the deal in order, if you built the seawall, you'd need some routing of...
That was the deal that led to, at the time that Gregoire, Nickels, and Stimms stood up, and then they announced, we have a deal to build the tunnel. And part of that deal was, and the reason why Ron Sims supported it, was because there was going to be a 1% motor vehicle excise tax for the benefit of King County Metro. And that 1% MVET hasn't materialized yet. And we've been lobbying. Since Dow Constantine took office, we've been working together to get that money. And we've come very close. But it has not. The legislature has not yet authorized that.
But Metro got some other MVET money.
They got the ability to do a vehicle license fee that will expire. So it was just a stopgap measure, so that Metro kind of wouldn't go off their own fiscal cliff and have to dramatically cut service. So they're still facing another fiscal cliff, which is when that authority for the vehicle license fee. It was only short-term authority. When that expires, there's another fiscal cliff. So I've been working with other mayors, with County Executive Dale Constantine, to try to get a funding package that will support Metro as well as support other local transportation needs like paving our streets and filling potholes and all the other work. It's a big deal. It'll be a high priority for us in the next legislature.
Are the legislators reluctant to pass that MVET because they have to get two-thirds?
In this case, they just need to give us the authority. So they don't.
Oh.
So it doesn't require the legislature for two-thirds. They don't pass the tax. What they do is they give counties and cities authority to ask for taxes. So what King County needs is the authority to raise more money. And then it would be up to, and it's not just King County, theoretically, you know, it would be every county would have this option. And every county transit system is facing real challenges with the decline in sales taxes from the recession. So it came very, very close in the last session. In fact, there were a majority of votes in both the House and the Senate. But at the last minute, as you may remember, the Republicans took over control of the state Senate from the Democrats on the budget. And it just got lost at the end of the session, so we didn't get it. So we're going back again, and we need it, because what we see is that Metro ridership continues to go up, and we really need folks to come into town to go to work, you know, for entertainment, and the demand is there. We can't possibly accommodate it with automobiles alone, which I've been saying lately, it's not ideology, that's geometry. There's just not enough room. We got to figure out better ways to get people into town. And on some of our corridors, there's so much demand for transit that your most cost-effective means is rail. And that's the Transit Master Plan.
All right. So you had wanted to get rail along Eastlake? What's the proposal in the Master Transit Plan?
What we have proposed is to put enough money in the budget for 2013-2014 so that we can do an alternatives analysis for getting from South Lake Union to the UW, and what we know from initial look is that the extension of the streetcar might be the most cost-effective way to do that. Once we complete the alternatives analysis start getting some conceptual designs, that will put us in a position to compete for federal funding. So we want to move as fast as we can. The Seattle City Council right now, several council members have offered an amendment to delay starting the planning. And I don't know why they want to delay. I don't think it makes sense, because the more we delay, that means that other cities will get in line for federal funding ahead of us. And we've been through this game in Seattle enough. You know, we should be looking to get in front, not fall behind.
Well, so you have a $2 million streetcar planning study in the East Lake Corridor in your budget. And Tom Rasmussen, the chairman of the Transportation Committee, says he's not convinced East Lake Rail is urgent, as the nearby UW will get light rail stations in 2016 and then up in our neighborhood at 45th by 2021.
Sure, and that'll take you to downtown, but we have tens of thousands of jobs now in the South Lake Union. They're not going to go backwards to link light rail to then head up to the UW. Here's what the data shows.
Right. They could take a bus. They could take the 70? I can't remember.
And let's talk about that. So what the Transit Master Plan shows is that, based on expert analysis and data, 25,000 people a day would use that East Lake line. That's as many people right now as use Link Light Rail through the valley. And we could build it relatively inexpensively compared to Link Light Rail.
Because you're talking about streetcar, tram, right?
Streetcar, sure.
Like what we have now.
Like what we're building on First Hill.
And what the South Lake Union trolley is.
South Lake Union streetcar. And, you know, that South Lake Union streetcar is full, by the way. The businesses down there have voluntarily put in money to get more service hours so they can get 10-minute headways, 10-minute wait times between streetcars in the peak hour. And we're talking 25,000 people a day. So the data says it is the highest capacity, one of the highest capacity corridors after Ballard that we could invest in. And we also know that the federal government now is switching its philosophy to fund more of these in-city systems rather than the big regional systems, you know, like BART, like Link. The feds want to put more money towards these types of systems that connect neighborhoods within urban areas, because they are highly efficient, because they attract so many riders. So the urgency is we want to get in line for federal money. The longer we wait, that money could go somewhere else.
Now, I, as you know, did not know much about this issue, and you mentioned it, so
There we go.
Here's our friend at the Seattle Transit blog who says the problem is that the 66 and the 70 have peak crowding, partly as a result of service duplication between the 66 and the 70, and partly because there's just not that many people in Eastlake. Both routes consistently show up in the bottom third of Metro's performance charts. So I guess he's arguing that there ain't enough people to justify that tram from. I'm
going with the transportation. If you look on the transit blog, you'll find other transit bloggers who are for the line. So I'm going with the people who did the analysis, not the bloggers on this one. 25,000 a day, and here's the deal: a streetcar, because it can be multiple cars long, it actually costs you less per rider. Your capital costs are higher, but your operational costs are lower. So it's actually when you get to a certain volume of customers of service, rail gets cheaper per customer. Now, we have 20 corridors we identified as priorities. We identified 5 high-capacity corridors. 4 of those 5, rail looks like the most competitive. One of the other 5 is Madison, and that would be likely some type of bus system because it's steep. The other 15 corridors are likely to be buses. So we're trying to get the right type of mode, the right type of service in the right place based upon this rigorous analysis of existing travel patterns as well as future travel patterns based on where the growth is occurring.
Right now, the First Hill streetcar starts where?
In Pioneer Square and goes up to the light rail station on Capitol Hill.
Up Boren?
It goes up Jackson.
Or Jackson and then 12th?
It goes up Jackson, kind of cuts over 12th, gets down to Broadway, 12th or 14th, I'm trying to remember now, and then runs the length of Broadway to the Capitol Hill station. We just receive funding from the federal government, from the FTA, to help us study extending that to the very end of the commercial district in Broadway. So that's an example of how the federal government is interested in funding these projects. We also receive funding from the feds to help us study the downtown connector, which would connect the South Lake Union streetcar line to the First Hill line.
Streetcar
line, yeah. So the federal government has funded that as well.
Down Denny or something?
No, we would either First Avenue or maybe a couplet on 4th and 5th. What we have to do is do the alternatives analysis now. What's the best way to get from Westlake to, you know, basically King Street Station area? What's the best way through downtown to connect those two? So we'll start serving downtown. The question is, can we get this out to the neighborhoods too? The line, if we extended that line out to Ballard, we're talking 26,000 riders a day. Again, this is, very, very effective use of transit dollars because the demand is so high. When you run bus service in these corridors, they fill up.
Well, what do you make of the Rapid Ride expansion? Haven't they met the needs outlying areas you're talking about?
I think the Rapid Ride expansion is great, and I think in the sense that we're getting more frequent service and more priority. And what King County is seeing, what Metro is seeing, is that the ridership is increasing in response to that. But it really tells you if you could get even more frequent and more priority faster from place to place, you'd get even more riders on top of that. So the demand is there, is what the Rapid Ride lines are telling us. And we're still struggling to kind of supply the transit for the demand that exists for transit.
All right, let me grab a couple of phone calls on this issue before I take the break.
Sure. People love talking transit.
Yeah, but then we have some other things to take on, too. Mike okay. McGinn is the mayor of Seattle. He's in our studios. Mark's in Eastlake. Mark, you live in Eastlake. Do you need a streetcar? No? All right, we lost Mark, but he'll be back through the magic of radio. We'll see if he comes back in a moment. Do you ride the streetcar? Have you ridden that streetcar?
Very rarely, actually. It's just not on my pathway.
You're bussing.
I'm biking.
And you're biking.
I'm biking mainly. Or when I'm not biking, I'm in the car. Before I became mayor, I was pretty faithful rider, the 358 and the 5, you know, as a compliment
down
to biking.
Greenwood.
Yeah, down Greenwood or down Aurora. And, you know, and every once in a while I'll get on the bus just so I make sure I know what it feels like. They're full, man.
Do it at 5 o'clock on a rainy
full.
Day.
They are
or
full.
Or 6 o'clock on a rainy
day. I know.
All right,
yeah.
Mark. Mark's in Eastlake. Mark, you there? No. All right, Mark's not there. All right, that's the way it goes. I guess he wanted to bring up streetcars versus buses, but we can't. So here, we'll take a bikers on sidewalks call before we take a break. Brian's on First Hill. Hi, Brian. Brian, you there? I'm calling at us. How's this? Brian, you there now?
Yes, I am.
All right, sorry, it was our problem.
So, oh, that's all right.
Mark, you can try again if you want. I apologize. You know, like you bikers are on the sidewalks?
Correct.
And what's your question or comment?
Oh, I'm sorry, Steve. Mayor, I am in total support of the First Hill streetcar. We're so looking for that here on First Hill. But one of the questions would be, we're adding the bike tracks along Broadway for dedicated bikes. I'm all in support of that. We've also painted the roads downtown and elsewhere with the share roads. My question is, being a pedestrian on First Hill and even going into downtown, adult bicyclists are riding on the sidewalks to go opposite of the way of the streets. We've gone through all this measure to give them. So is there something we can do about adult bicyclists? Children, I can understand on a sidewalk, but sidewalks are 4 feet, pedestrians.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on this one. It's one of the real challenges. One of the advantages of the what we're doing on First Hill is this idea of a cycle track. So fully separated from the cars, fully separated from the pedestrians. What we find downtown is, you mentioned one, which is if a bicyclist is, you know, wants to go the opposite direction of a one-way street, they may not want to go down a steep hill the right way, up a steep hill to go half a block. Bicyclists should, in busy streets, get off and walk. The rule is that bicyclists are supposed to yield to pedestrians and move at a speed on sidewalks that's safe for pedestrians. And if they don't do that, you know, we should be on them to do that. But part of the challenge, I think what you're getting at too, is sometimes there's no safe facility for the bicyclist. And what we need to do is figure out how to have a good separated system for bikes through downtown as well, so that they don't ride on the sidewalk as much.
Do you want to see the rule change so the bikes aren't allowed on sidewalks?
Well, it's kind of a challenge. Right now we have a judgment call, and I'd be interested to hear from people about what they think. It's I understand why people would move to the sidewalk in some places. For example, you know, there are parts of town, if you were climbing a steep hill through a green belt, which we have in parts of this town, on a narrow roadway, you might go up on the sidewalk and there aren't really any pedestrians there. So, but in other places where there are a lot of pedestrians, the safe thing to do is, again, to get off and walk if it's a short distance, or what the rules require is that you move at a slow enough speed so that you can yield to pedestrians and certainly not frighten them by whizzing by them. So it's a question of behavior.
Are those rules enforceable with laws behind them? Like if you're on the sidewalk and you whiz by, is there an infraction?
You could be cited for your behavior then.
All right, so you're in a little bit of a conversation with the council on this question of funding the Eastlake Rail study.
Correct.
When's the vote? Or is there a vote?
They like to wrap up their budget before Thanksgiving, before the week of Thanksgiving. They usually wrap up the Thursday or Friday, or maybe the Monday of Thanksgiving week. I'm trying to remember now. Basically, any time now, this week or next week, they'll be making their decisions on this. So right now there's something called a green sheet. You have to get at least 3 council members to sign a green sheet to have it up for consideration. And a green sheet is a change to the mayor's proposed budget, my proposed budget. And right now they've got a green sheet with 4 signatures on it to delay Eastlake.
Well, so what's your response to this? I mean, I am just reading somebody's column on the transit blog because I haven't followed this, but I am curious. No way. This is Bruce. I should give Bruce credit since I'm reading it. Bruce Norrish on the Seattle Transit blog. There's no plausible rail way that rail bias can get you from two mediocre to middling bus routes running at 15 to 30 minute headways to a well-used streetcar with twice the capacity per vehicle at 15 minute headways or better. And any claims of the contrary should be regarded as askance. It might be slightly faster and more reliable than an improved trolley bus, which would induce a little more demand, but there's not enough room on Eastlake for a link-style exclusive right-of-way to significantly boost speeds. But you're not talking about link style. You're talking about Seattle streetcar style, sharing the lane with cars.
Again, the Transit Master Plan process, which we went through, which had professionals looking at the likely demand, found that there was 25,000 riders a day. And I think you'll find on any particular rail issue or bus issue, you can find anybody to argue any side of the issue.
I know. I'm happy to do that if you'd like. I'd be happy to argue the pro-rail side if you'd like.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what I have, that's why we're doing the alternatives analysis in this corridor, is we'll go out and we'll analyze the difference between bus rapid transit or streetcar. But what our transit master plan showed is that the rail has the potential to serve the most riders at the least cost per rider in that corridor. That's what our data shows.
You also have the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention.
By the way, if you look at the density of jobs in South Lake Union and the density of jobs in the U District, it stands to reason.
Let's move on.
Let's move on, brother. Okay.
Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. That was started what?
Actually, started under Greg Nichols.
Greg Nichols started that,
right?
You've included it,
yes,
in your budget. You've
we've maintained it. We've maintained it in the budget.
Sally Clark is asking some questions on the council about its funding, but she is saying, you know, I want to confirm ongoing funding, more than $3 million a year. I want to fund the final development and testing of a risk assessment screening tool. Wants to fund the staff needed and fund a strong media evaluation of the Seattle Youth Violence Prevention Initiative so we can know what works and what doesn't.
Here's the deal. We, in the tough times when we had to make deep budget cuts in our budget, I didn't touch funding for kids. If it was about kids, if it was about youth violence prevention, if it was about job training for people looking for work, I wouldn't touch it. And it didn't hit human services either. Those were areas where, you know, they were needed even more in the tough times. And what we knew is that we have approximately 1,000 kids enrolled in a program that was designed for around 800, and we have more than 400 on the waiting list. And we have specific criteria for how you can get into the initiative, which provides mentoring, programming, direct assistance, gets kids to a safe place and out of trouble if they've been in trouble with the law, if they've been arrested for crimes that don't qualify for detention, they're released back into the community. If there are kids that have been missing school, truant a lot, and which are, we know from data, they're at risk, or if they're victims of violence and may seek retaliation, those are our criteria for whether or not somebody should go into the Youth Violence Prevention Initiative. They're at serious risk. And what we know is we have hundreds of kids who are at serious risk of violence that we are not serving with the program. So this year, when we had more money, I was really grateful our economy was doing better and that we had a little more money. We proposed to expand it by 450, evaluate how to make it work better, and expand the depth of the programming. The city council is saying, well, we're not sure we want to expand the program. We want you to evaluate first. Our position is, look, let's expand the program and we'll evaluate on how to improve it. You don't stop a program to evaluate it. You don't leave these kids at risk without services when they need help. And we know that the services make a difference, and we can evaluate about how to make it even better, and we should. And in fact, that was in our budget. They're not just looking to delay the program. This is the other piece, you know, delay the expansion, leave these at-risk kids just out on the streets, basically. They're also proposing to move the evaluation into a legislative department body. You know, they're going to take some of the funding that was meant for kids and move it to a legislative branch organization, the city auditor's office, which is controlled by the city council. They're going to move the money over there. So they're talking about reducing services to do more evaluation and delaying services so that they can do the evaluation. And the city budget auditor isn't an expert on youth violence. We were going to use $150 and get a third party to do an evaluation.
Is that cheaper?
What we could do better.
I mean, a third party cheaper than the city auditor? I mean, isn't that what that person's for?
Well, they're doubling the budget for evaluation, proposing to delay expansion of the program. I really don't get it. I mean, we got a lot of kids out there in need, and the program has a lot of public support, and there's a lot of concern behind it. So we've been asking the council, look, let's expand the program, and we agree with you on evaluation. Let's evaluate, but evaluate as we go, as we do with so many of our other programs.
Like?
We're providing human services to lots of people in need. We're repairing our streets. We're putting police officers out on the streets. In all of those areas, we're doing evaluation of, is there a better way to do it than the way we're doing it? But we don't stop doing it. You keep doing it.
So when she says a more careful evaluation, Sally Clark, what you're seeing is a more expensive evaluation.
Well, again, they're going to move the dollars to a legislative branch body, you know, to do the evaluation.
All right. So many things to debate. You thought there wasn't much to talk about. Real quick, you're getting on a coal train soon?
Yeah. Hop a ride to Powder River Basin in Wyoming. Catch an empty back, one of the 18-mile-long trains a day that will pass through downtown on the way between Bellingham, a proposed coal port, and the Powder River Basin in Wyoming.
So what's your evaluation process right now in looking at the potential for those trains?
What we've done is we asked Parametrics, a transportation firm, to evaluate, as a first step, just to evaluate what is the effect on the city of Seattle of having coal trains run through town. There are 4 at-grade crossings in SoDo. There are 4 at-grade crossings along Alaska, just north of downtown, you know, heading into the Sculpture Park area and the rail yards. And what effect will this have on the length of time that those crossings will be blocked? And the effects will be significant. In fact, we're going to give a briefing today to review some of those effects.
Bad?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the effects are on traffic, but they're also on safety as well, you know, because how do ambulances or fire trucks get from one side to the other of the train tracks? We do have a fire station on the shore side of the tracks, but if you have a serious emergency, you know, you'll need more equipment than that.
All right, more on that, but just since you mentioned safety, just real quick, Jerry's saying, why can't the city of Seattle keep all sidewalks open during construction? The crossing back and forth is crazy. I used to live in Manhattan. They had construction zones that set up some, you know, walkway around every site.
You know, I think we've gotten better at that than we used to be. And that was one of the things that came out of the pedestrian master plan the city adopted shortly before I took office. We have, on some occasions, where there's not high pedestrian traffic, closed a sidewalk. But in high traffic areas, we're working to keep those sidewalks open. If there's a specific one he's concerned about, email me at mike.mcgann@seattle.gov, and I'll take a look at that, because I agree with you. When there's high traffic pedestrian use in an area, you want to keep the sidewalks open.
All right. A month from now, we'll be talking politics, and all the elections will be over, and we'll know so much. Thank you,
yes,
sir.
Yes, we will. Thank you.
Mike McGinn is the mayor of Seattle. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 9:53. I'm Andy Hurst. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? That was Ronald Reagan's famous question to voters back in 1980, and later today, we'll pose that question to you. KUOW's Ross Reynolds takes your phone calls at 12:40, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Give us a call, 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Cloudy skies and 54 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 59 today. We're expecting clouds all day with a slight chance of showers. It's going to be cloudy tonight, the low in the mid-40s, cloudy and rainy tomorrow, the high in the mid-50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield. Regents, your health, connected. Regents Blue Shield serves select counties in the state of Washington and is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Emmy Award-winning writer and host of radio and television, Greg Fitzsimmons, was in town talking about politics and the campaigns. He's a regular of David Letterman, Conan O'Brien, Howard Stern Show. He also hosts the Greg Fitzsimmons Show on Sirius and also puts on Fitz Dog Radio. Katie Sewell asked him about our election and our system of all-mail ballots.
Yeah, I think females should also be able to vote. I mean, I think that men have always been in charge, but I think that has to change. And if not with you as a strong female, I think your voice should be heard. Also, I think this mail-in system is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. I mean, what is this, a money saving?
Well, there's a lot of reasons behind it. Some people think that it gives people a chance to actually pour over the information more than they would if they're at a polling place.
Yeah, people need to pour. Can't you pour for 6 months before you go? I mean, if you're cramming for the test, I don't want to see your answer. There's this focus on undecideds. You know, it's like the number one thing you hear polled, or, you know, who the candidates are going after. Undecided people. Let's break that down. People who have been bombarded with political ads, so many debates it makes your head spin, CNN around the clock, every newspaper you read. If you're undecided, you aren't going to vote. If you believe in Obama, there's a 60-something percent chance you'll actually leave the House and go vote. Same with if you're a Republican, 60-something percent chance. If you're undecided, I'm going to peg it at about 4%. And so they're trying to factor in these completely confused people that live underground, that they're going to suddenly pop up and charge the polls to be the kingmakers. It's not going to happen. We need to get people in, well, in Washington State, again, go out, support the proposition to legalize marijuana, support the right for people of the same sex to engage in the same kind of hostility and domestic violence that the rest of us are. And then whatever school initiatives are going around, throw money at schools. That's the future. That's all we got. We don't make buttons. We don't provide any services that don't rely on us breaking new ground, challenging current technologies. And so we need to spend all the money in the schools.
That's Greg Fitzsimmons. He's a comedian, a big NPR fan, wants to become the voice of public radio, he said. He spoke with KOW's Katie Sewell.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of a machine called the stringer. It connects individual solar cells to each other to form a string of 10 solar cells. 6 strings of 10 cells are connected to form a 60-cell solar panel. Listener Nicholas in Bellingham sent us that sound. He and his fellow technicians hear that sound all day at iTech Energy. Build in the future, one solar cell at a time, strung together. What interesting sounds are you hearing? What is the sound of the future economy sound like where you live? Record 30 seconds of a sound and send it to us, along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday at kuow.org and put sound of the day in the subject line. Tomorrow, we're going to mostly avoid politics, at least national politics. So we were thinking that one interesting call-in that we would like you to partake in is about names, since we were finding out recently about names and social stratus and names and what images they convey for candidates. Well, so what about for your name? How unusual is your name? And where'd you get it? What do you think of it? What message do you think it sends to other people? We're going to take that up tomorrow on Weekday. And coming up on Weekday, we take up a conversation with Nancy Pearl. She's going to talk about science fiction. That's coming up next hour. A bunch of other stuff as well. Do stay with us.
Good morning. It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away.
Support for KUOW comes from the law offices of Hillis, Clark, Martin, and Peterson.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.